Please give a warm applause to Tobias Fiebig, who will be talking about IP version 6 global scanning. Thank you.
So, good evening, everybody. Nice that you still made it, even though it's 11 p.m. Of course, this is not work of me alone. It is joint work with colleagues from UC Santa Barbara, Kevin Bogalter, Shuang Hao, Christoph Krugel, and Giovanni Wigner. First thing about me, I have a Bachelor of Science in Cognitive Science, and somewhat noticed that wetware is not really my life. So I actually went on to get a Master's in System Network Engineering, and since I got that, I'm more or less desperately trying to get a PhD from Professor Feldman and Professor Seifert at TU Berlin. My research interests can be summarized as basically what nobody else does, but not because my stuff is ingenious, but because most people say, well, that's stupid, that won't work anyway. And I think we all know this as misconfiguration. So you all know these nice people that are running database servers on the internet without authentication. I have heard of a big ISP that actually managed to run their provisioning system on the internet, which was not that good for connectivity for their customers. There's also other nice examples. So mitfahrgelegenheiten.de was actually pretty good in doing backups. They even encrypted them and stored the AES key with it. And there's always the fun of finding an iSCSI device that belongs to some bulletproof hoster read-write on the internet. And something I had to learn, there is something called remote DMA. What could be better than doing DMA over the internet? So basically, whatever I will tell you today is directed at finding these. But first things first, ethics. I may tell you about a nice tool to have a lot of fun with, but basically...
What are you, stoned or stupid? You don't hack a bank across state lines from your house, you get nailed by the FBI. Where are your brains, in your ass?
Follow this good advice. Think about this event, think about the amount of bandwidth you have, think about the amount of bandwidth other people have, think about them having this nice time between the holidays at the end of the year where they don't want to work, which might happen if suddenly DNS servers start crashing and other services become unreliable. So, back to my motivation and some view of related work. The first part will be a little bit dry. So if you start to get bored, there's a special slide where I ask the person next to you to wake you up, just right before the fun stuff starts. So please don't run away. So in the beginning, there was ZMAP. That was like 3 years ago. And it started this whole thing about we can scan the whole IPv4 internet. We can do like internet-wide security evaluations. And that was actually a whole lot of fun. So I think 2 years ago, there was this nice service in one of the lecture halls at this event where you would have something like chat roulette, only with VNC service. Yes, you laugh, but that actually brings us to the second point. It stops being funny when you find some asset construction facility in India on one of these slides. ZMAP was heavily used to scan for heartbleed and to do analysis on how heartbleed was mitigated. ZMAP was used to scan for, at least open TCP ports where you could then do an key exchange to see how is key sharing between HTTPS servers in the wild. There was research on amplification attack servers, well, basically the amplifiers for the amplification attacks. And this ability to exhaustively scan actually helped the security community a lot. But as with all good things, or rather not so good things in this case, IPv4 is coming to an end. There's only so many addresses, 2 to the power of 32, in fact, theoretically. And there's a lot of work investigating how this is getting more and more exhausted, and by now getting an IPv4 address is actually pretty hard. So what happened is that people introduced IPv6, like 20 years ago, roundabout, I think even more. With IPv6, there comes a lot more addresses, like 2 to the power of 128, theoretically. And we can actually see that IPv6 is starting to get adapted. So the graph I have here is actually a bandwidth graph from this event. And we see that at peak points, we saw around 25% of outbound IPv6 traffic. This is a little bit skewed because as soon as you deploy IPv6 to your user network, you will suddenly see a lot of traffic to like 2 or 3 big players like Google with YouTube and Facebook. But it still demonstrates that IPv6 is a thing that's coming. However, if we start to use, for example, ZMAP on IPv6, we will suddenly have to wait. I cannot really pronounce that number, but it's really, really huge. And I don't really intend on living that long. So, let's come to related work. So, looking at IPv4 addresses was an interesting tool. It was not only used in the security community, but especially there, and it helped a lot there. So, people want to have the same thing for IPv6. Current work is relatively focused on starting or trying to observe IPv6 address usage in the wild. Not doing active scans, but having some vantage point where they sit, where they can read something, which provides them information about used IPv6 addresses. So Vromsky, Plonka, and Berger, they are using the access logs of a large CDN. Of course, as good scientists, they don't disclose which CDN this is, but one of them has an Akamai mailing address. Xux et al., who are mostly the vantage point freest of them all, they are using various DNS data sources, but not the same as I will present in this talk. And then there's Grasse et al. They do have, for some reason, access to a large European IXP and can look on flow data there, and thereby can get information about utilized IPv6 addresses in the wild. So let's quickly go over these. So Vromsky, Plonka, and Berger actually provided nice work where they used their data sources to train a tool which could then predict another active, that means replying to ICMP, IPv6 address based on the data sets they had observed previously. They are mostly using the CDN data. They have a small, really, really tiny portion of data that was gathered as the data I will present on, and they utilize traceroute data. This has certain drawbacks. For example, their CDN logs, of course, do not really represent a lot of, well, servers, especially not servers in the wide internet out there. Traceroute data is, by nature, really, really, really biased towards networking devices because, well, it's traceroute data. The work by Grasse et al. In principle is somewhat similar. So they also try to predict active IPv6 addresses based on the data set they have. So then we have Sys et al. Sys et al. Are actually doing various minings on DNS data sets. So they have recursor data sets. So they actually get logs from DNS recursors. But they are also doing something really fun where they would actually do a PTR lookup for every address in the IPv4 space. And then do an quad A lookup to get the IPv6 address for that FQDN. And their work is actually one of the big motivations for what I'll be presenting today, because they figured out that IPv6 security is not really doing that well. In other words, it's doing terribly. But, well. So, in summary, I looked in my basement, I didn't find a CDN. I looked it off further and I didn't find an IXP. And when I asked my ISP if they wanted to let me read their recursive access logs, they also said something including no. Well, but on the other hand, so if I was a politician, I would now be like, but we have this IoT, this Internet of Things, this, we really need this scanning to protect all the people. So, well, we came up with methodology. By the way, this is the point where you want to wake up people next to you that didn't really care about related work. So, first things first. So, there's another person I'd like to credit. It's Peter van Dijk. I'm not really sure if I can do the IJ thing correctly because I'm not Dutch. But I hope I, well, I tried. Anyway, I met him at last ITF in Berlin. And as I, well, heard he's Dutch, I believed him when he started to talk about DNS. And he said, if I want to get a lot of IPv6 addresses that are assigned to servers, not clients, I should actually look at, well, IPv6 reverse DNS. He said he had some like interesting preview result thingies, and I should start to dig into that. So, well, as I said, Dutch people know about DNS, like most of the DNS servers we're currently using come from the Netherlands. Let's try it. So, let's start with a short recap. So, IPv6 address, as I said, 128 bits, and you can represent it in 32 so-called nibbles. Those are the little things representing hexadecimal characters we see here. And reverse DNS is a way to get for an IP address you have an FQDN, a fully qualified domain name. You do this by doing some transformation to the IPv6 address. So you first reverse it. And then you put basically points between each of the nibbles for different levels in the PTR tree. And as top level domain and second level domain, you have ip6.arpr. And under that tree, you then find a record. And that record you can do a PTR request to, and then you get a FQDN from the DNS server. So the next thing that is somewhat important at this point is how DNS works. So RFC 1034, I hope I get this right. I see somebody in the audience that will probably beat me up if I don't. It's not really clear about it, but tries to mean it, so it got clarified in RFC 8020, the meaning of NX domain. Technically, NX domain should mean if you receive the reply NX domain from a server for a point in a tree, like the one to the right, that there's nothing at that point you requested or anywhere there under. So what this technology basically is descending trees where we received a no error for the root node. We can actually try this. So we have our given root here, which is ip6.arpr, and we do a DNS query for 0.ip6.arpr. We get an NX domain. So we don't descend in that tree. We do the same for the one, we do the same for the 2, 3, 4, up to the E, and we always get an NX domain. We know, well, we don't have to descend that tree. But when we have the F, we do get a no error. We don't get any data back, but we get no error. So, well, we descend that tree. Let's try. Oop. I never managed to clear out class, sorry. Anyway, we do the same thing again, and this time we start with a zero, and we immediately get a no data, or no error. So we can descend that tree already. Oop. And do the same thing again, and then we descend that tree, and by doing this 32 times, so in an IPv6 address, there are 32 nibbles, we can finally arrive at utilized IPv6 addresses. And you see, if we start with a zero, this is basically a depth-first search in this huge DNS tree that is spanned out by the reverse DNS name system. So, as I said, this is in itself not new. You have RFC 7707, which actually discusses this as a possible technique for network reconnaissance in smaller networks. And they actually reference this Peter van Dijk, who recommended this technique to me. And he actually wrote a small blog article about this like 3-4 years ago, and provided a Python implementation which you can utilize to actually scan the network, or rather DNS PTR prefix. This was also the starting ground for the tooling which will be provided to you in the end of this talk. First, what I used to conduct these scans is, it's basically the compute server we have for doing machine learning at the research group. My colleagues were not so happy that they had to stop doing this while I did my scans. But as I produce something called academic code, which is basically like startup code, but we don't call it production ready. Everybody who laughed works in a startup. But I'm pretty sure that somebody who is actually better with code than me, so like a programmer who can actually write production code, will also be able to run this code, well, the code they write themselves, on their laptop. So the first thing when I thought about this technique was that I do a depth-first search, which is a pretty bad thing if the first part of the tree is on a really, really slow DNS server on the other side of the world. So you want to have the opportunity to do some kind of breadth-first search to parallelize over different DNS servers. For this, I basically just iterate in four nibble steps. So in a first step, I will iterate up to a length of four nibbles for all possible PDI entries. Then I will collect all of these, and for each of these, do the enumeration step for another four nibbles. Based on flavor, on personal tastes, one might also opt to go from 16 nibbles to 32 directly, so from 64-bit to 128-bit, which may have advantages, may have disadvantages, but we will see that later when we look at the data. So this was basically what I built directly after IETF. I hacked this together, went to the office, ran it, was pretty happy because after I let it run for a week, I found 70 million records. So I then looked into the data and was wondering why I got this funny email from a large ISP with them complaining about a lot of traffic from my machine to theirs. And I learned about a really nice feature you want to have in your reverse zones when you're offering reverse zones, or rather, networks to customers and end users, which is dynamic reverse zones. So I have an example here. So when you have a big network and you don't want to manually set all those 2 to the power of 64 reverse entries for all the possible users you could have, you just set a script in your DNS server that actually generates a reverse FQDN for any given, reverse pointer record. They also may be static, and I also found funny, dynamically generated looking domains that are probably DNS tunnels or something like that. At least they were always returning 32 bits of something random. Point being, in this case, you will never find an NX domain. So when your algorithm is just plainly stupidly going in there, it will find a lot of records, but they all belong to, well, however big this this dynamically generated reverse zone is. I thought about a heuristics. And I first thought about doing something computational linguistics enhanced stuff where I would compare returned returned FQDNs to figure out if they may or may not be actually somewhat related. Turns out doesn't really work, doesn't really perform. What performs far better is just trying to query static set of records. And if at least three of these exist, assume the domain, or rather the subtree, is dynamically generated. So at least three records is a personal preference. The picking of filling up the tree to a length of 32 nibbles with zeros, ones, twos, threes, up until F is a not so personal reference. Some people recommended to me to do this with random data, but then you actually have to have enough non-blocking entropy for that. So, well, taste question, but this actually works. So using this, I actually tried this again. So I started at ip6.upper, let it enumerate, and then I found 1.6 million records. And you have to see, I started off with like 70 million. I was like really amazed. And now I only have 1.6 million records. So I was somewhat confused. Which brought me to another nice finding. So there are DNS servers that are, for some reason, not RFC 8020 compliant. So they may actually send NX domain instead of no error. We have an example here. So if the DNS server on which f.ip6.upper is resident on sends an NX domain because it has no explicit record at that point, well, then I will not see 0.f.ip6.upper. And to actually counter this issue, I got the idea of seeding my algorithm. So I do not start at ip6.upper, but I start at various well-known predetermined to exist, well, subtrees of the DNS tree for ip6.upper. I built a somewhat funny algorithm for that, where at each step, so at each nibble length, remember the slide a couple slides back, so for four nibbles, I would actually crop the seed record to a length of four nibbles and re-add the full record length again of the seed record, just so that I get at each iteration all the information possible from my seed records. The seed sources I used were the RouteViews project and the RIPE NCC, how is it called? Something with BGP view, I always forget. Anyway, these are publicly available and actually are documented in the script that will be published with this talk. Other possible sources are, of course, the algorithm Sysadol used, where they would actually do the quad A lookups for the returned FQDNs of IPv4 reverse pointers, and basically whatever data set you can get your hands on. So if you can, for example, if you are at a big event where a lot of people are using remote IPv6 servers, and you were actually able to read the network traffic, which I recommend not to do, then you could also use that as a source for seeding. So with the seed set, I actually ran the programs again. This time it took nearly 3 days, running in parallel with 80 threads, and I found 5.3 million records, which is sounding really small, but due to the, well, state of IPv6, deployment practices in IPv6, this is still pretty decent. So it doesn't show a full picture, but it shows a large subset. But I was not really satisfied with the speed of this, so I tried to parallelize more, because I realized that my server was, well, not really that busy. I tried to run it with 400 threads. It ran faster, found less. And the lesson I had to learn was that basically the one IP address I used for resolving ran out of sockets. So if you want to heavily parallelize this, do it on multiple machines with more addresses to actually use for outbound DNS queries. Other thing that falls into this is if you are running this yourself, have a local resolver. Because latency to your local resolver, for example, in this network, the resolver output offered by network operations will extremely increase the length of these scans, and it possibly will overload them. So don't run it against your speed port. So this is basically the startup for the case studies. First look into this. You see basically plotted here the amount of queries I needed for records in /64s. And we basically see a nice distribution between extremely structured zones, so zones that have :::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::::�¶ possibly EOI 64 addresses. To the left are basically those where I need more queries to find less records. And then here are the structured ones, which, due to the depth-first nature of the algorithm, will also be found first, that are then found with less queries. But I promised more fun parts. You can also utilize this tool to look at something specific. So from the huge data set you collect, you can single out specific networks. And this, for example, is an overview of how a software as a service provider does their network assignment policy, so how IPv6 addresses and networks are assigned with that service provider. Figuring out which service provider this is left as an exercise to the reader. And I was told that this is too academic and just boring. So I looked at something else, which is a little bit more fun. So I personally do not really do a lot of stock trading, but if you look at IPv6 networks, people suddenly have a whole lot of addresses to use. So they will address everything. They will address loopback addresses with public addresses. They will address IPMI with public addresses. Everything. So if you look at such a network, in this case, starting here in September, with 65K of hosts roundabout, you suddenly see a huge jump of around 10K in just a matter of, well, 2 weeks. And like 2 months later, you can realize that this SaaS provider actually announces a record sales quarter. So this is one of the opportunities where you could use this tooling for, actually gathering information on company growth. But which is probably a lot more fun is looking at topologies. So for me, this was the most fun thing I could do with this, apart from security scans, where we all know what they will turn up. So first thing I did was looking at an IXP. By the way, I'd like to mention that this all is my personal opinion, and I'm not representing affiliations and so forth. So I rendered graphs. Gray are hosts. Blue are /64s. Red are /48s. And green are /32s. And if you zoom out a little, you can also see black ones. Black ones are hosts that are for some reason connected to 2/64s or more. So after importing this, this actually looks more like a Borg cube than anything fun. However, as it's a basically directed graph, one can sort this, make it float apart a little so you can actually recognize parts of the structure. You can add funny labels to it. And then you can look at what you can see. So this is a network of a huge IXP. This is, for example, their POP in Hamburg, basically their peering network. Of course, they also have a dependence in Frankfurt. And nice thing you can actually see is, so our black friend over there, there you can actually see the networks the customers are having behind the router behind the PeeringNet in Frankfurt. They also have this famous black holing infrastructure, which you can see, being connected to their provisioning and some internal routing or interconnect infrastructure. And Firewall 6 appears to be their central firewall in Frankfurt, with a whole lot of hosts connected to it, for example, an Elasticsearch system for customer accounting and processing flow data. But I think nerds are somewhat more into other networks. So this is an example of NASA.gov. But there's also somewhat bigger topologies one might want to look at. Is everybody familiar with .mil? So, little side note, I'm also doing the monitoring for network operations, and we will now look into it. At the moment, the only network, I have the feeling that I know the topology of better than the network at this conference. For reasons, it will remain anonymous for the purpose of this talk, but technically the data sets are public. So, let's have a huge journey to through a network. So, like all good networks, it has a border router and some portal systems, some administration interfaces, and possibly user access networks. They also run like network infrastructure, for example, hosts called Big Brother, which is actually an ancient monitoring system. I want to give them that. Which they actually had to have a lot of servers for, but they are currently apparently migrating to Prometheus, which is a somewhat newer monitoring system. So, let's look at their infrastructure. How do they run? So, they run a lot of open source software, so we see Gentoo. Kerberos, probably not so who, and they also have a Puppet production host. They also have an Admiral Akbar, which made me think. Which made me think that it might be a honeypot. But what worried me most is actually this one. On a little more serious note, what this also teaches us is that these networks are run by nerds. So, some more fun things due to popular demand, technical IoT. The reductions happened due to, For some reasons, it is not opportune to expose the IP fridges and military installations when you have collaborators from the United States. Another nice thing we actually found in our data set is TCP 666, the number of the backplane. 666, in this case, is a placeholder. Because for reasons, I actually talked to the C-cert of that company before this talk, and they were like, nice, yeah, we kind of know about this. And I was like, cool, nice, so I can talk about it. And they were like, yeah, well, with us. So when we are scanning some of the IPv6 addresses we collected, we would find this TCP port being open on hosts that would also expose Telnet, SSH, and BGP, and somewhat look like backbone links. Funnily enough, the TCP port, which should be on the slides, was more related to a technology you usually don't find on a backbone router. After some communication with a couple of friends, we figured out that technically this port should be bound to localhost on the systems. as it is used for some backplane services. Funny side note, the vendor didn't even know how the customers managed to get this exposed. So then we have DHCP v6. We all know the issues of, devices that suddenly get IPv6 addresses and become then reachable. My most favorites were printers. And something you see a lot is that these devices that are then exposed and that are really vulnerable actually do have a forward pointer for the FQDN that is returned for the v6 address that points to an RFC 1918, so a private network address. Other things you find is IPMI, so out-of-bound management in various forms, what you basically use when everything burns down. One really nice large operator actually has all their IPMI interfaces reachable with ICMP version 6, which made me wonder what would happen, which I, of course, didn't do, but, well, it's something I'm wondering about because, well, you don't really want your IPMI on the internet. And also something for the people a little bit more into network infrastructure, besides our exposed backplanes, you will also find a lot of RIP out there, a lot of BGP and Telnet SSH of internet infrastructure and internet backbone services. Another fun thing to find is Docker. One part is the nice things you can deploy with Docker, for example, Elasticsearch. It's really amazing who runs Elasticsearch as a service without authentication, only reachable via IPv6. But reachable with IPv6. For Docker instances, I don't know if you do know what these TCP ports mean for Docker installation. This is actually an API which you have to protect. There's information in the documentation how you can enable authentication. There's actually good blog posts on how you can enable authentication using certificates and an Nginx reverse proxy. But you can also just expose it to the internet. So this is just a set of the opportunities you can have, which you shouldn't have. Besides actually doing the right thing and doing firewalling for your IPv6 network, you could also do something, well, security by obscurity. You could try to configure the reverse DNS zones in a way that always returns a no data or no error, basically masking them to this. It feels hard to say that this is an attack, but basically to this. This was already available in 2012 when Van Dijk first played with this. There's tools available, not applicable to all DNS servers out there, but the concept should be clear, so it should be implementable. On the other hand, we should think about techniques that probably are applicable, even though this specific technique I just presented is not available. So let's quickly conclude. In the end, you can try to reject packets, but you cannot hide your network topology. You should think before setting PTR records, and you should think before connecting things to the internet. You can download my toolchain from the GitLab instance of my research group. And there is an academic publication coming up in March 2017, which is also dealing with this technique on a more measurement-related point of view. Thank you, and I'll be happy to answer any questions that there are.
Thank you very much indeed. First question, as usually, goes to the Signal Angel.
Did you actually think about trying DNS zone transfer to see if the server would give up a bunch of PTR records due to misconfiguration?
Using other techniques like AXFR is discussed in the research publication, but we didn't actually try it. Well, there's a Git link.
Next question goes to microphone number 5.
You got me lost. Oh, sorry. You got me lost a little bit here when you said that, and maybe correct me if I'm wrong, you should run your own local DNS resolver to get faster, I don't know what. And I'm kind of wondering, did you use some kind of asynchronous I/O in order to parallel your resolutions? Instead of using a local resolver, or maybe I misunderstood what this was solving.
Okay, so running a local resolver on the machine you're doing the measurements on is basically solving the issue of overloading the local resolver of your research institution, having your system administrator standing in your office, being really, really angry. You know, all these things that happen when they suddenly have to deal with a DNS recursor that is doing mostly the queries you're doing and not those of other people in the room. Or research institute.
I see. So it's not improving the speed.
It actually helps a little with speed because either you do the resolving yourself, or you put it somewhere else, and you basically have to wait for the answers. So if you have a little bit of latency towards your recursor, the whole process will pile up, take longer. If it's on your local machine, you basically reduce one small part of latency. But again, you can probably do this better when you do the recursing and resolving from the toolchain, which I didn't do because I'm not a good programmer.
Okay, thank you.
Next question goes to microphone number 1.
Okay, so did you actually consider that there might be a few servers hidden in the those subnets who have these generated PTR records?
Yes, there may be servers hidden in there, but due to the dynamically generated PTR records, I cannot verify this without exhaustively enumerating the whole tree, which just gets really, really large.
Okay, so you just,
I don't know and I cannot know.
All right, thank you.
Okay, next question goes to microphone number 2.
Hi, from experience I found that IPv6 reverse lookups are more sparse than the IPv4 versions. So do you have a reference on how many hosts you find with that technique versus hosts that are there without reverse lookup?
I would really love to have that. I also so basically, if you want to make the statement you just basically asked for, you would have to compare this data set with another independent data set which looks at another angle of IPv6. For example, large IXP, for example, CDN data set. CDN dataset will be biased for clients and servers, so most probably the IXP dataset. At the moment, I didn't have availability of those, so I didn't investigate that.
Okay, microphone number 6.
You mentioned that results or the dataset of your work are public, so where is the dataset?
Well, it's actually stored in a distributed manner on a lot of DNS servers. And as you know it from all cool platforms, that there's a dedicated download client you have to utilize. Download client source code is available at that GitLab location.
Okay, microphone number 5.
Hello. So, quick question. Most of the data on the slides were sort of Western, and the .mail exploration and so on. So, just as a general question, did you explore the IPv6? Did you explore a lot of this on the Asian networks, of, say, Korea, China, which has massive IPv6 use? because of the latency thing, you know.
Actually, I didn't really focus on a specific per continent analysis. I mostly presented so far in the academic work the technique in itself, and I picked interesting case studies that would demonstrate the potential of the technique. But what you suggest is actually an interesting point for further work.
I would, for anyone interested in that, I would recommend Hong Kong as to the starting point to do the scans. Cheers.
Okay, any more questions? Okay, thank you very much.
So.